Hello, I'm Charles Arthur, and this is a special bank holiday edition of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. This week's programme is an extended interview with the man who has in the past called himself the world's biggest failure, Kane Kramer. You may not recognise his name, but the likelihood is that right now you're actually using a descendant of the device he devised back in 1979. His plans for the digital audio player were a forerunner to what the MP3 player actually became. The designs for a device that stored music in a digital form are amazingly similar to what the iPod ended up looking like, although in the late 1970s, the gadget could only hold a total of 3.5 minutes of audio. You wouldn't get much of this podcast into that. But Kramer's company split up and couldn't renew the worldwide patents on the idea, and they eventually lapsed. Apple has since acknowledged the work that he's done, but Kramer has made little money from his invention. He's also since come up with ideas for metal-based paint, a phone call transcription service, and he's also the chairman and co-founder of the British Inventors Society. And despite his experience, he is positive about the future for inventing in the UK. I met him at The Guardian's Radio Reborn conference last week, where he was discussing a new service of his that links music downloads with DAB radio. He's packed a lot into his 53 years, so when we sat down to talk, I wanted to find out how he started. What did he do first when he left school?
The very, very first thing I did was go and work at a printer's. I was doing a printer's apprenticeship to learn the print trade. Unfortunately, after a couple of weeks, I'd learned how to set the machine up and was caught actually overseeing a running machine, which could cause the union walkout. So I left that. And
these were the heady days of, what, the early 1970s?
Yeah, absolutely. I left there and went to Fortnum & Mason, strange enough. Spent 6 months there in their footwear department. Basically, the family business was footwear, cowboy boots, and I wasn't allowed into the family business until I could get a real job working for someone else.
And 8 years after you left school, in 1979, you developed the idea of a digital audio player. How did that come to?
My brother at the time was managing Olivia Newton-John, and she had just sold 2 million of a particular album, and we got 3 million returns. And the reason we got 3 million returns was because of the huge number of counterfeits that were produced. So the whole process started with me really thinking about, I wonder if there's a way that we can overcome the problem of all this counterfeiting. I know it would be a great idea if instead of having all these records kind of being manufactured and then introduced into the system, maybe if the record shops had a machine and the songs on the machine in the shop, they could program them onto a tape player, onto an audio cassette, and then everyone would have everything in stock all the time. I thought perhaps they could actually send it down the telephone lines to the shop, so everyone would always have everything in stock all the time. I thought, of course, this is going to sound like rubbish because it's analog, and that sort of nudged me towards, well, how can I get a brilliant quality sound down a shitty telephone line? And that led me to the concept of chopping it up into little bits and pieces and sending it down the line and then reassembling it at the other end, which we know today as music downloading.
At the time, digital music, digital encoding was really in its very, very early days. The CD was really only just about being thought of. The whole Red Book concept was in its infancy, really.
Yeah.
How were you so far in the forefront of thinking about the sort of, you know, the digitalization of the music? What had you come across that made you think of that?
I had, as a pet hobby as a kid, I was very into computers. Although I left school early, I built my NASCOM 1, which was the world's first kit of a computer, long before the likes of the Sinclair ZX80 and Commodores, long before all of those. I built my first computer on a circuit board. It didn't have any memories to forget what you programmed into it when you switched it off.
And you had the idea of sending the information down the line digitally. And when you looked around, was there any way to exploit this? Was there any way even to do this at that time?
There wasn't a way to do it. I needed a huge amount of memory. So in 1980, I did some research looking at the development from the number of switches from the original development of the valve through the transistor and then semiconductor memory. And in 1980, I drew that curve and I projected it forward. And according to that curve, as just as a state of fact, you have enough memory without compression to record a full album of playing time by 1999. So I knew that I wasn't in it for overnight. I knew I was in it for the long game. In any event, even if you'd have put a digital audio player into the hands of every man, woman and child on the planet, they couldn't have done much with it because no one had digital audio tracks yet. The studios didn't have any digital audio mastering equipment. So the very first thing I set about doing was to develop solid-state digital audio master recorders for use in applications in film, recording studios, radio stations and this sort of thing, so that we could actually create a digital base and format. And that was in fact 44.1 kilohertz, in fact exactly the same as compact disc is. And in fact, Philips in the early days did work closely with me in providing test equipment and chips and various other things. They had a hunch that this this music downloading idea had some potential future for it. Of course, bandwidth was much narrower in those days. We didn't have the broadband that we have today. So a lot of people do think, well, you know, you couldn't have delivered music like that. But 90% of all records sold are in the top 30. I identified that fact with Music Week. That means that if you've got the top 30 in store on a central database, just by that central database handshaking for accounting purposes only a tiny amount of data, you could have then supplied 90% of the whole country's demand for music just based on that 30 tracks in the shop. So it was totally achievable then, and I think that there are opportunities today with technology. I don't think it's being very well used at the minute.
So your idea would have been like a sort of a hub-and-spoke idea almost, which would have kept a lot of record shops alive, that's selling the downloaded music burnt onto CD, which I think HMV and others have tried to experiment with, but hasn't got very far when they've tried it.
No, I mean, these days as well, in burning anything onto anything is kind of a little bit sort of an archaic approach. Now I actually think, and I wouldn't have said this 30 years ago, that in 2009 I now look on the idea and concept of having to go to the computer to download a piece of music as being equally archaic and out of date.
You think the next step is just to put it straight onto your phone, or to?
It could be your phone. I think that the next step will be a much, much greater utilization of digital, of DAB radio, digital audio broadcast radio, the ability to actually purchase tracks from there, and a mechanism in place to account that.
You came up with the idea back in the 80s when you
1979 actually
1979
was the original idea. When you and drew 81 the, was the pattern,
and yeah. You drew the graph, a sort of Moore's law graph. What was your next step? Was it to did you think, well, that's a nice idea, but I'm sure someone else will come up with it, or did you?
Well, I started to pitch it to different people, and you know, one of the problems I had was that it was very futuristic, and that people couldn't really get their head around the idea that actually you might not need any moving parts, or that you might be able to have some kind of music audio device which does, you know, which isn't a record or a tape player. I mean, so much so that when I did build it in 1984 and demonstrated it to people used to make me take the lid off so I could look inside to see if it really didn't have a record player inside. So very big change of thinking.
And did you get a patent on it?
Yes, I did, yeah. It's granted worldwide, international patent. And then I then started to approach people for investing. And the very first people, Michael Morris and Ken Finken, that I approached, they invited me to go hunting one day, and that was the day that I actually got shot from the guy in the next bar. I should have taken this as a hint right away. They did make me quite a nice offer. They didn't want to partner with me. They wanted to buy it outright. They offered me £1 million through their lawyers. They actually were... He was CEO of, I think it was Isle of Man Bank. Apologies if it's not. Anyway, I didn't take their £1 million, and probably.
Do you regret that now?
I think in some respects it would have been nice. Yes, I mean it would have been nice to have had the £1 million, but I'm not sure if I would have kept it, because about 3 months later, these two guys were locked up for fraud. Well, they were taking the money from their investors in the bank, and they were investing it in high-risk speculative projects.
Do you think yours a high-risk speculative project? I mean, given the way that things have transpired, do you think...
Well, it wasn't a high-risk speculative project for me. I certainly wanted to pursue this digital audio player by producing things like audio sample devices, sampling keyboards, samplers for audio delay and things like this for recording studios. And at the time, no one else in the company really knew what I was talking about, and they didn't really want me sort of diversifying. I mean, long before the emulators and Insonics ever hit the marketplace, the sort of sampling keyboards, in the very, very first digital audio player prototype back in 82, you know, we discovered that when we varied the clock time, you could play, hello, 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 sort of back the tone. So I thought, this is great, you can record, a bell and then play it back at any tune. And I was desperate, wanted to make this device that I'd already built and put a keyboard on the front of it and sort of make it for sale. But all my directors said that I shouldn't take my eye off the ball and I should stop inventing and concentrate on working on the thing which, we were all sort of aiming at. I mean, yeah, I did have an absolute belief that that would succeed in the marketplace. Perhaps the most hardest thing to believe is just how long it took. You know, when you give someone a roadmap and it's there as clear as a bell, as clear as the nose on your face in front of you, and even still the industry managed to really cock it up good time, really big time.
So the initial patent, you got some financial help with that, didn't you?
The very, very initial application I paid from my pocket, but then within a year the international phase enters and you have to make a decision to patent it all across the world. And it was quite nerve-wracking time because I had to come up with £15,000 for this particular stage, to secure the patents internationally, and I only had £7,500. At this time I'd started talking to Paul McCartney's outfit, and basically I pitched the idea, and Sir Paul was unquestionably the first musician in the world to actually believe and to see that music downloading in a digital audio device was the future, and he backed it.
That's quite ironic, given that the Beatles now is one of the very few bands that is not available for digital download.
It is kind of incredible that, and there's a lot of coincidences. The Apple, of course, and Apple Records, and subsequently Apple having the iTunes, and I think there's even been one or two little tete-a-tetes there, something like along the lines of Apple versus Apple.
Indeed. But if your patent was still in force today, because I believe it's expired.
That's correct.
But if it was still in force today, would it apply to the iPod?
It would apply to lots of aspects of the iPod. And of course, when you say the iPod today, it's sort of a generic term for a very broad sort of covering media player, which does all sorts of things. Also, there's lots of specific technology. Just to give you an example, things which I didn't invent on the iPod. I didn't invent the on-off button. The button that you hold down for a while and then it switches it off?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that, for example, but then neither did they. So you've got lots of little, features.
But what would be covered by your patent that is in the iPod and that is in other, MP3 players?
There's lots of aspects to do with iTunes and the iPod itself, from how it digitizes the music, how it lays it into memory, how it overcomes certain problems to do with the fact that electricity moves far quicker than we want. So if you were to play a track back without using limiting means, you would hear the track. It might be a 3.5-minute track, but you'd hear it in sort of half a second. So to actually slow that down, mechanisms. I've also drew the actual device, the style of the device, the four-way scrolling control. I mean, certainly if you took everything out, which I did back then, what you'd have is you'd have a plastic box, probably, that didn't play anything today.
When did your patent expire?
Oh, all different times, all over the world. And I must confess, I haven't made sort of a science of following it. But I've read all sorts of different dates. Some people said some of them expired, I believe, as recently as 1998, I think, and others expired so have read 2001. But of course, my designs for the drawings go on depends in what country, but for my life in 70 years. So, there is some saving grace in that I do have an element of intellectual property, I believe, still remaining and to be resolved.
So now you sort of portray yourself more now as an inventor.
Well, I always was an inventor. In fact, the digital audio player certainly wasn't my first invention. And I've had many since. And in fact, in 1997, with another product called Metal Paint, a paint made from real metal particles in a water-based solution, which enables you to put a real metal finish, copper, brass, bronze, copper, etc., onto plastic, wood, or anything else, it won me British Inventor of the Year in 1997. When I was 17, years before I came up with the first digital audio player, having had my my beloved VW Beetle broken into for the stereo to be stolen, I invented probably what was my first invention. I realized just about a year later when I was in the States. I basically came up with the idea of a car alarm. Now, I used to park my car in a dark garage. So the car alarm, I took apart a single-channel radio receiver from a model aeroplane that I had when I was 12 and rebuilt it with a little circuitry and a little light-dependent resistor. And basically, I drilled a little hole in the dashboard and this little light-dependent resistor went in that hole. Now, I used to park my car in a dark garage at night. So if you wanted to steal my car stereo, you'd go in there, you'd either have to turn the light on or you'd have to shine a torch in the car to see if I had a stereo. And my car alarm went off before you could even, like the minute that you could even, just by looking at it. And then it would transmit a signal from the aerial into a little box that I could carry around with me or had in the apartment that I lived in. I went to America the following year and I saw a very similar device, actually, and it had that current year's date on it for patent applied for, although it didn't actually use the bit that I really like, which was the light-dependent resistor in the dashboard. Anyway, that was a long time ago. I was a mere nip of a 17-year-old then, and I had ideas about changing the world. I was just worried about keeping hold of my car stereo.
Life's quite hard for an inventor, though, isn't it?
Bloody hard for an inventor, yeah. I mean, you know, the whole process of inventing, if you take any other business or any other industry, for example, if I wanted to set up a newsagent, I could just go and buy all the products. I could buy my Kit Kats and my Mars bars, and someone else will worry about the production, the developing, and the intellectual property, and the content, and the manufacturing, and the distribution, and everything else. But if you're an inventor, you've got all that to do, and you've got to invent it, and you've got to protect it, and you've got to prototype it. You've got all the pre-production to do, masses of research and data to be collected, market evaluation. I mean, a whole massive layer on top of everything else. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily suit the inventive, creative mind to be trying to be inventive and creative and doing sort of very, very linear sort of mental thoughts at the same time. If you're going to be doing blue sky, you're best spending as much time as you can doing blue sky.
What would you say is the prerequisite then? Because, I mean, you've described how in your early life you built your own computers, you had radios, remote control planes, you took them apart. What would you say is the prerequisite then for children becoming great inventors, or even good inventors?
Good general knowledge, being hands-on, making things, you know, being at one with materials and the fabric of society and what's available.
Do you think that we get that in the education system at the moment?
I think that we're getting it to a point, and it's something which is definitely been improving over year on year. It's something that we're becoming more and more aware of. I mean, 10 years ago, innovation, invention, and technology, you know, hardly bumped into the school curriculum unless you were at perhaps a very nice private school where all the pupils' parents probably all running businesses, and they make it their, you know, their business to make be certain that the children have activities like, for example, developing products and running a company with that product. But in broader education, there's still quite a long way to go. But these are being addressed now like never before.
What's missing?
I don't think anything's missing. I think we're on the right track. We just need a lot more of the same. You know, We're going in the right direction. I think the whole state of invention and innovation. I mean, considering that the Japanese equivalent of UK trade and investment, I did some research some years ago. Almost 60% of the world's manufactured product has been invented in the United Kingdom, but nothing like 60%, of course, is manufactured here. In fact, I'd be surprised if 6% was manufactured here. I doubt it. We're a very, very, creative. Creative country, and so I don't think that necessarily that there's something historically flawed within our system. But actually knowing how to take advantage of that creativity, knowing how to protect the intellectual property, and knowing how to roll it out and gaining experience to roll these ideas out to market and protecting them for the benefit of UK PLC, this is something which needs just close concentration, or more close concentration on. I don't think it's anything we can, you know, we could say that we've arrived at. It's an ongoing process.
If we're so creative as a country, why are we in such a financial mess?
Well, we are creative as a country, but we're not the greatest at actually developing and rolling our ideas out to market. A lot of products go overseas, a lot of products go to the States, even though ultimately, strangely, they don't often end up being manufactured there. But they're great marketeers, and the British are not the best marketeers.
So, Ken Kramer, you've during your lifetime, you've invented a car alarm. You've pretty much invented the idea of a sort of hub-and-spoke download distribution to music stores. You've invented the idea of the digital music player years before the iPod. You're looking at the idea of buying music over the air. What's next? What's next in your...
What's next? Well, a Monocle, which stands for Monitor Call, which is a new service which enables two people to make a legally binding verbal agreement over the telephones. In a nutshell, if I wanted to make a deal with you, I pick up the phone, dial into the public telephone exchange, it prompts me for your number, I dial in your number, your phone rings, it says you're being connected to a Monocle secure call. We then have our conversation, whatever, I'm selling you a car, we agree the payment, etc., etc. When we put the phone down, the public telephone exchange, which is Home Office and Ofcom regulated, sends me an email with an attachment, which is an encrypted audio file, so I can listen back to the actual call that we made between us, and I can forward it to you, so we both have a copy of what was agreed. So that's basically streamlines, very fast way to streamline the way we work. That's one of the things I'm working on. The other one is a new kind of water purifier, which is for personal use in third world countries, basically, for places where they have water, but they don't have access to clean water, drinkable water.
And is life easy as an inventor?
Well, it's easy if you can just live off eating your ideas. is life easy as an inventor? Well, you know, if I sort of answer that on behalf of the majority of inventors in the United Kingdom, or probably throughout the world, the answer to that is a resounding no. It's not easy as an inventor, but would I have it any other way, and would I be doing something else other than this? No, there's nothing else I would rather be doing. I think that to be, and a lot of inventors would say, you know, that they would rather be inspired and have hope and drive and motivation for something they believe in than just to sort of be in a sort of, you know, situation where, you know, life is boring, life is dull, it's 9 to 5 and there's never any change. I mean, the thing about life of an inventor is changes your daily diet.
Ken Kramer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can find out more about the British Inventor Society at thebis.org. That's it from Tech Weekly this week. Next week, there's no bank holiday, so we'll be back to normal when Jemima will be talking to Paul Brown from Spotify. In the meantime, I'm Charles Arthur. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Jeff Jarvis with details of the latest Media Talk USA podcast. If the second richest man in the world refuses to buy newspapers at any price, what hope is there? And we speak to Craig Newmark, the founder of Craigslist, the basic-looking website that gets 22 billion page views a month.
Even now, sometimes on Daily Show, you see some of the best reporting around because they have a bunch of people, including interns, who sit around what I hear are 15 TiVos.
Out now and the first Tuesday of every month. Take the hard work out of listening and subscribe. Guardian.co.uk/MediaTalkUSA.
Media Talk USA from The Guardian and paid content.